So I'm Greg Lewis. I'm from the University of Ontario Institute of Technology, or how we like to call it, UOIT. Now, I hope you don't mind, but I'm going to take a minute to plug our new graduate program that will be coming online. We're going to be starting a master's program in modeling and computational science, and hopefully it's in the final stages of approval, and hopefully we'll start it in it will likely be starting in September 2007. There's a small chance it'll start this September, but it's unlikely at this point. And of course, there's plenty of room for dynamical system stuff, so I just wanted to let you know. Okay, so this is joint work with Bill Langford, I wanted to say. So the title of the talk is Bifurcations in a Differentially Heated Rotating Spherical Shell. Now, this is a system that I'm actually interested in, which is the title, I think, needs a little bit more explanation. We're actually interested in the flow that's contained in a spherical shell. So there's a fluid contained between an inner sphere and an outer sphere. Okay, the whole thing is rotated as a rigid body about this axis of rotation. Okay, what I mean by that is that the inner sphere and the outer sphere have the same rate of rotation. We are going to assume that gravity is radial everywhere. Okay, and we're going to impose a temperature difference between the equator and the pole. And of course, this is an interesting physical system to study in itself, but to sort of motivate this a little bit further, consider this schematic diagram of a planet. So like our planet, this planet absorbs more solar radiation at the equator than at the pole, and this causes a differential heating between the equator and the pole. Okay, so if you imagine that it's hotter at the equator, the air will rise here, cooler at the poles, the air will fall here, and a convection cell of this type will be set up. If the heating is symmetric about rotation about the polar axis, then you'd expect this convection cell as well to have that symmetry. Okay, so if you it would look like a donut around the northern hemisphere. And we're going to assume also that there's a differential heating between the equator and this pole as well. That's just a reflection of the northern hemisphere. Okay, so what we're interested in doing is seeing how, as we change the rotation rate and differential heating, what happens to this convection cell? Does it break down, and how does it break down? Okay, so the model that I'm going to be using is I'm going to use the Navier-Stokes equations in the Boussinesq approximation. So the Boussinesq approximation, in the Boussinesq approximation, we assume that all the physical quantities of the fluid are constant except for the density, and we assume that the density of the fluid varies only linearly with temperature. The biggest help in using the Boussinesq approximation is that if the variation of the density is small enough, then the fluid can be considered incompressible. We're going to write the equations in spherical polar coordinates and look at it in a rotating reference frame. We're going to assume at the inner sphere that there's no fluid velocity, so we assume the no-slip boundary conditions. At the outer sphere, we're going to assume stress-free boundaries. Okay, for the boundary conditions for the temperature, we're going to assume that the outer sphere is insulating, so no heat is lost to outer space. And on the lower boundary, we're going to impose this sinusoidally varying temperature. Okay, so it looks something like this, where this is the latitude, essentially. And so at the pole, you have the lowest temperature, and at the equator, you have the highest temperature. And the profile is sinusoidal. Okay, so just some notation here is the inner radius I'm going to call R0. The gap width will be capital R. And the aspect ratio, which will be one of the parameters that I vary, will just be the ratio of the gap width to the inner radius, the radius of the inner sphere. Okay, so in this talk, I'm going to be talking about the steady flows that have a particular symmetry. And that symmetry, I'm going to assume, is that the flows that I'm going to be looking at will be invariant under rotation about the polar axis and reflection about the equator. So we're going to look for transitions in flows that have this symmetry, and we're not going to look at flows that break the symmetry. This helps simplify the problem in a couple of ways. The obvious way is that it reduces the problem to a problem in two spatial dimensions instead of three spatial dimensions. And the second way it simplifies the problem is that it introduces additional boundary conditions at the equator and at the pole. In particular, we're not allowed to have flow across the equator or across the pole, and that actually simplifies things a lot as well. I'm also going to be looking at steady-state bifurcations, and I'm not going to be looking at bifurcations to time-periodic solutions. Okay. So the numerical computations are an important part of the analysis, and so I want to say a few words about those. To compute the steady solutions, I'm going to be looking at how the solution changes as I change a parameter, and I'm going to use pseudo arc length continuation for that. And as I follow the steady solutions, as I change my parameter, I'm going to be computing the linear stability of the solutions. Okay, and to do that, I need to compute eigenvalues. And the method I use is the implicitly restarted Arnoldi method, and we need to use Cayley transformations as well. So in the case of solving for the steady solution and solving for the eigenvalue problem, both of these can be reduced to a system of three steady PDEs in two spatial dimensions. So when we discretize, we do it on an n by n grid, and the spatial derivatives are discretized using second-order centered finite differences, and this leads to sparse matrices. And in order to get a reasonable size n, which is 50 in the case that I'm talking about here and the results that I'll show, we actually need to use sparse matrix techniques. And another important property of the matrices is that they're non-symmetric. Okay, so for the steady solutions, when we do our spatial discretization, we end up with a system of nonlinear algebraic equations that depends on some parameter. Okay, and we need to solve these this system of equations. we're going to use Newton's method to do it, and Newton's method with continuation. And the way this works is that for Newton's method to be effective, you need to have a good guess for the solution, and then you do iterations to converge to a good approximation for the solution. The way continuation works is that you need to know the solution of the system of equations for one value of the parameter. And this is no problem in our case because we know when there's no differential heating and no rotation, there's no flow of the fluid. Okay, so the trivial solution satisfies the equations. So continuation, the idea is that you increment the parameter a little bit and use the solution you know as a guess for the new value of the parameter. Okay, but we use what's called pseudo-arc length continuation, and I'll show you why in a second. But the idea of pseudo-arc length continuation is you assume the parameter is not known, okay, and you then have a freedom to choose another condition. Okay, this F is up to you to choose. Okay, so the way it works is graphically is that say we know a solution for this value of the parameter alpha 1, and we know this solution. This is the curve that we're trying to get. This describes how the this describes the solution as you change the parameter. Okay, alpha. We take a guess for a solution at some point further along the curve here by following a tangent a certain distance. So we get a new guess for the solution, and then we do our Newton's iteration, and with this choice, or with a popular choice of F, there are a couple different ones you can choose, but with a popular choice of F, your Newton's corrections take you on a line that's perpendicular to the tangent. Okay, so you will converge to this point here. Okay, and once you know this point, you can then follow a tangent again, get a new guess for a solution further along the curve, do your Newton's corrections following a line perpendicular to the tangent, and end up at a curve at a point on the curve here. Now, the important thing about the pseudo-arc length continuation is that you can compute around these things, these limit points, or a saddle node bifurcation. Okay, so with a sort of standard method of continuation, you would basically fall off the curve here if you assume that alpha is constant, okay, in your iterations. Okay, so for the eigenvalue problem, we linearize about the steady solution, and doing some simplification, we can end up with a generalized eigenvalue problem that looks like this. Okay, and when we discretize the spatial derivatives, we can then get a matrix eigenvalue problem, a generalized matrix eigenvalue problem that we need to solve to approximate the eigenvalues of this, the actual eigenvalue problem. Okay, so as I said before, we use implicitly restarted Arnoldi method. This is a memory efficient iterative method, but the important thing is that in its sort of basic form, the Arnoldi method isolates eigenvalues with largest magnitude. So we're not interested in eigenvalues with largest magnitude, we're interested in eigenvalues with basically the largest real part. So that means we have to use a Cayley transformation. Upon doing the Cayley transformation for this system here, I've written A and B now for the matrices, we compute eigenvalues for C. The reason this works is that the eigenvalues of our generalized eigenvalue problem that we're looking for, if they have real part greater than the average of these parameters, this is not these are parameters you choose, it's not a parameter of the system. Okay, so if the real part is greater than the average of these parameters, then these eigenvalues are mapped to eigenvalues with large magnitude. Okay, so we can choose the parameters of the Cayley transformation so that we isolate the eigenvalues with largest real part. Okay, so so now I can talk about the results. The first thing I want to say is that the parameters here, I'm using aspect ratio of 1/2, and the differential heating is 4 × 10⁻³. Okay, so this is for small values of the differential heating. Okay, we get what we expect, a single cell, a single convection cell. Okay, so let me explain a little bit what you're looking at. So this is the inner sphere. This represents the inner sphere. This represents the outer sphere. And what I've done here is I've actually scaled the gap so it's a little bit easier to see. Okay, so this is not, this doesn't represent the actual radius. Okay, and remember the gap width is 1/2 in this case. Okay, this panel here is the stream function for the vertical velocity and the radial, the polar velocity, and the fluid tends to follow these lines of constant stream function. Okay, so there's a rising of the fluid at the equator and a falling at the pole. Now, I've assumed that these solutions are invariant under rotation about the polar axis. So indeed, this single cell sweeps out like a donut shape around the northern hemisphere. Okay, and of course, there's a reflectional symmetry about the equator as well. So this represents the azimuthal fluid velocity. Okay, and the plus, so all of these contour lines represent flow into the board. And this is the zero line, and all of these contours represent flow out of the board. Okay, and this is the temperature deviation, and this is the temperature from the sinusoidal profile that I specify on the lower boundary. Okay, so it's a little bit cooler than the temperature I impose here, and it's a little bit warmer here than the temperature I've imposed here. Okay. So as I change my differential heating now, I do see a transition, and in this case, what I see is, even though the azimuthal fluid velocity looks similar, we now have a two-cell type system. Okay, so and it's these are counter-rotating cells. This rotates this way, and this rotates the other way. Well, it's supposed to rotate the other way. Sorry about that. Anyway, so if I then increase the differential heating a little bit more, then I get a transition to this this flow here. And now I have the azimuthal fluid velocity actually still looks similar, but now I have three and sort of a little baby cell there. And I have, these are all counter-rotating, rising of the fluid here, falling at mid-latitude, and then falling there, rising there, et cetera, et cetera. So this particular flow pattern looks very similar to what you would see in the atmosphere. There's a very strong cell near the equator. There's a relatively weaker counter-rotating cell at the mid-latitude. In the atmosphere, this mid-latitude cell is a bit larger. And then there's a weak counter-rotating cell as well near the pole. Okay, and this is these are average these are the flow that are averaged about lines of constant latitude, okay, in the atmosphere. And then there's this baby cell there that is not observable in the atmosphere, but that's okay. So the azimuthal fluid velocity is also similar to what you would see in the atmosphere. If you've heard of the jet stream, there's a strong flow from the west to the east, okay, in the mid-latitudes in the upper-level atmosphere. Okay, so this strong, relatively quick flow here is representative of the jet stream. And this flow here is flow from the east to the west, and there is actually an analogous flow in the atmosphere near the equator. The if you've heard of the trade winds, which is a relatively persistent wind that flows from the east to the west, and the merchant ships used to use it to sail from the old world to the new world. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to change the aspect ratio, and I'm actually interested in looking at the transition from the one cell to the two cell. And that's because things are a little bit more clear and how this transition occurs when I increase the aspect ratio. Okay, so now the aspect ratio is 1, and the cell looks a little bit more squished, but it's still a single cell. Now when I increase the parameters, I get a transition to the two-cell system, okay, the two counter-rotating cells. But if you've noticed, I haven't been actually saying that this is a bifurcation. I've been saying, well, we have a flow transition. The fact is that there's no bifurcation. When we go from this flow to this flow, there's no bifurcation that occurs in the sense that there is no eigenvalue that crosses the imaginary axis. So if we look at the eigenvalue with largest real part for that steady solution, for low values of the parameter, we have a one cell. For large values, we have the two cell. But if you look at the eigenvalue, it grows to a maximum that is still negative, okay, and then starts to decay again. And if you look at the, quote, bifurcation diagram, well, there's no bifurcation. It's just a single line in this just represents the, this is the norm of the stream function. Okay, it increases, but there's no bifurcation. So what's happening here? Well, to see what's happening, I'm going to increase the aspect ratio quite a bit. Again, we have a single cell. It's quite squished, but it's still a single cell. And now when we increase the parameters, the differential heating, we see the generation of a two-cell flow. Okay, and now there actually is a bifurcation that occurs. Okay, in this case, one cell, two cell, the eigenvalue increases, crosses the imaginary axis corresponding to this saddle node bifurcation. Now it's positive, it increases to a maximum to about here, and then starts to decrease again, and then it crosses the imaginary axis again, and that corresponds to this saddle node bifurcation, and then decreases along this branch. Okay, so the transition from one cell to two cell is associated with this pair of saddle node bifurcations. Okay, so in summary, this is what's happening. For small values of the aspect ratio, varying the differential heating, we have a transition from one cell to two cell. Okay, for large values of the aspect ratio, transition from one cell to two cell is associated with a pair of saddle node bifurcations. So you might expect that in the middle somewhere there's some critical aspect ratio where you see a hysteresis point or a cusp bifurcation. Okay, indeed this is the case, but we have to compute it. But before you do, I just want to show you how this looks on a two-dimensional bifurcation diagram. For small values of the aspect ratio, you have a single solution. Okay, that's here. For large values of the aspect ratio, there's a region where there's three solutions. Okay, and that would be corresponding to this region here. Okay, so if indeed this critical eta exists, then we can find it. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to actually find this point computationally. First, a couple bits of notation. The first is that the cusp bifurcation is codimension 2, and the two parameters I'll use are the differential heating and the aspect ratio. I'm going to write my equations like this. U is the dependent variable, so it's a vector of functions. The dot is differentiation with respect to time. LU is the linear part, and N is the nonlinear part. And in the Navier-Stokes equations, the nonlinear part has this bilinear form. Okay, that's why I wrote it like that. Okay, so if we find a cusp point, then the cusp point necessarily satisfies these three conditions. The first one is easy. It's that there's a steady solution there. Okay, time derivative equal to zero. The second condition is that the linearization about the steady solution U0, which is this, the L0, has a zero eigenvalue. The last condition is that the coefficient of the second order term on the center manifold is equal to zero. So this is what the equation will look like on the center manifold, and if there's a cusp point, then this coefficient A here is equal to zero. If you do the center manifold reduction, you can show that the coefficient A can be given by this formula, where these angled braces are the inner product. Okay, the phi here is the eigenfunction corresponding to the eigenvalue 0, and the phi star is the adjoint eigenfunction corresponding to lambda equals 0. Okay, so now I'll use my fancy computer. So what we do is we're going to set up a defining system of equations. What's going on here? How am I not getting out of here? Maybe I won't bother. Something weird happened to my... No. Okay. There we go. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to set up this defining system here, okay? And what this amounts to is each of these parts of the defining system correspond to the three conditions. The first one is easy. That's just that U0 is a steady solution. The second one, G is equal to 0, to see how this satisfies the second condition, okay, which is that there's a that the linearization has a zero eigenvalue. What I'm going to do is I just look at this equation here, which is zero. I forgot to mention that the G and the G prime are actually scalars that are defined by these two systems of equations. Okay, so when G is equal to zero, then L0V equals zero. That just says that V is equal to the eigenfunction phi, okay, or times some constant. Okay, so now to see why G prime equals zero corresponds to the last condition, that the coefficient of the second order term vanishes. Okay, let's just put G prime equals zero in here, and then take our V and plug it back into our nonlinear part there. And this says basically that if the second equation has a solution when G prime is zero, it says that the right hand side here is in the range of L0. Okay, it's in the range of the linearization L0, and if it's in the range of L0, it means that, so this is our right-hand side, it means that it's orthogonal, if this thing is in the range of L0, it means it's orthogonal to the adjoint phi star, okay? So that means that this term will be equal to 0. Okay, so indeed we did the computation, and we found that such a point existed. These equations were satisfied for this value, for these values of the parameters. Okay, so in summary, we looked for steady solutions with a given symmetry. We showed that there is this flow transition, even though we saw there was a flow transition from the single cell to the two-cell system, even though there is no eigenvalues crossing the imaginary axis. And we saw that this was explained by the fact that there is this cusp point. So for future work, I didn't talk here about the transition from the two-cell to the three-cell system. Okay, that was they sort of run into each other, and it's not really clear what's happening. I have to figure that out. I can look at symmetry baking bifurcations. I've found hop bifurcations that I haven't looked at yet, and I've also seen higher codimension bifurcations in the model. So that's it. Thanks.